White Network presents the International Jew Study Hour. Reading and commentary on Henry Ford's great classic about Jewish power in America.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and serious students of The International Jew by Henry Ford. Welcome to our study hour on 13 September 2012. I am Carolyn Yeager, here with my talented co-host, Hadding Scott.
Hello.
Tonight, we've got a big night, and I hope you're going to really enjoy this. We're going to complete the last 8 paragraphs of Chapter 9 that weren't able to complete last week in that long chapter. That title of that chapter is The Historic Basis of Jewish Imperialism. And after that, we hope to complete Chapter 10, An Introduction to the Jewish Protocols. So, Hanning, I have a little summary of Chapter 9 up until the place where we stopped.
Oh, good.
It's not too long. I didn't really do a very good job of it, but it gives us some idea for people listening. It starts out with the sentence, a great unloosening of speech with reference to the Jewish question and the Jewish program for world power has occurred in this country since the beginning of this series of articles. So they think they've really brought some things, brought all this out and people are talking about it. And it is in newspapers or it's in magazines or writing articles and so on, some of them anyway. And he talks about that. There was something in the Chicago Tribune where they actually used the word Jew, he said, in the headline. And for the first time, he thinks, ever. And then there was a real good article in the Christian Science Monitor. And now remember, this is 1921, or is it still 1920?
Uh-oh. Only 20.
Yeah, 1920 still. Summer, July. It's like in July. Then they point out that Bolshevism contributed to Bolshevism contributed to this, and all Western governments were concerned about Bolshevism at that time. So it was seen, it was seen as a real threat, and it was known that it was Jewish. So this put some Jewish movements under suspicion, and Jews in general to some extent. And points out that it's worthwhile observing the contrasts and similarities between the Gentile and Jewish reaction to this alleged movement to establish a Jewish imperialism over the world. Well, I'm kind of jumping ahead here, but we pointed out that we don't like the using the word Gentile for all non-Jews. That's a Jewish kind of Jewish word for us.
It's very Judeo-centric.
Yeah, but they use it in the International Jew quite a lot, and it was commonly used. And Gentile is almost a synonym for Christian, at that time. I mean, that's what they're kind of talking about. And they're talking about white Europeans. They're really not talking about every other, Asians or Arabs or anything like that. But they would fall under that. Okay, Jewish publicists first deny, a point that's made is that Jewish publicists first deny that there is any kind of Jewish imperialism or world order being formed they deny it without qualification. It's all false, they say, all a lie, all hatched up by enemies of the Jews in order to stir up hatred and murder. But then, as the evidence accumulates, the writers say the Jewish tone changes. Well, suppose it is true. These publicists say, is it any wonder that the poor oppressed Jews, driven to madness through their sufferings, should dream dreams of overthrowing their enemies and placing themselves in the seat of authority? And then they say that the Americans make a distinction between Russian Jews and American Jews. Like American Jews are all right, but actually we know now that most American Jews are Russian. Are originally Russian Jews.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, they're so bad. And then Well, I have this quote from the Christian Science Monitor that I already mentioned. A quote from their article, lengthy editorial, says that in spite of this, it would be a tremendous mistake to conclude that the Jewish peril, given another name and atmosphere, does not exist. The Jewish peril is, I guess, was another name for the protocols of the Elders of Zion, right?
Yeah, I think that's the name under which it was published in Britain.
Okay, then two preconceptions to be guarded against that they brought out. I thought these were important, so I'm putting them in here. One is that the Jewish imperialistic program, if such a thing exists, is of recent origin. And here they're tying in now, preparing to talk about the protocols, because one of the things that the international Jew seems to accept pretty well is that it's very possible that this is a Jewish plan, or, you know, Jewish idea, maybe not a plan, but thinking from way back, and this whole program, therefore, is not recent, but something that ties back in, as we talked about last week with the Sanhedrin and the idea of the chosen ones and so on. And the second preconception to be guarded against is that every Jew one meets has secret knowledge of this program. And they made a big point of saying that most Jews don't know anything about it. But they did admit that Jews will go along with whatever is decided for them. And they realize that it's in their best interest, too. You know, that it's going to be an advantage to them. So that makes them culpable, I think. And then finally, they say the idea of a Jewish autocrat, you know, who's a one top ruler of the whole everyone, is too strange to most Europeans to even consider. And also the idea of a conspiracy to take over the world, or the idea of world domination, is also alien to European minds. And so we don't accept that very easily. And they talked about then some about the chosen ones. That is a concept the Jews have had for so long. And the Sanhedrin, which was a group of 10 super elites that goes back to ancient times. So now we're ready to finish this chapter. And you are the reader, Hanning.
There are always being held, year after year, world meetings of the principal Jews of all lands. They come together whenever called, to the disregard of everything else. Great judges from the high courts of the various countries, international financiers, Jewish orators of the liberal type, who have the ear of the Gentiles, political maneuvers from all the parties represented in the world, they assemble wherever they will, and the subjects of the deliberations are made known only to the extent they will. It is not to be supposed that all of the attendants on these conventions are members of the inner circle. The list of delegates will show scores of persons with whom no one would associate Lord Reading and Judge Brandeis. If the modern Sanhedrin meets, and it would be the most natural thing in the world if it should, we may be sure it meets within the closed circle of those persons which the Jewish aristocracy of money, intellect, and power approves. The machinery of a Jewish world government exists ready-made. The Jew is convinced that he has the best religion, the best morality, the best method of education, the best social standards, the best ideal of government. He would not have to go outside the circle of that which he considers best to get anything of which he may need to advance, of which he may...
Which he may need, no
yeah,
up.
To get anything which he may need to advance the welfare of his people, or to execute any program which may have to do with the outside world. It is the ancient machinery that the international Jew uses in all those activities which he permits the world to see in part. There are gatherings of the financial, political, and intellectual chief rulers of the Jews. These gatherings are announced for one or another thing, sometimes. Sometimes there is a gathering of Jews in a world capital with no announced purpose. They all appear in one city, confer, and depart. Whether there is a recognized head to all of this is yet to be disclosed. There can be little doubt, however, as to the existence of what may be called a foreign policy, that is, a definite point of view and plan of action with reference to the Gentile world. The Jew feels that he is in the midst of enemies, but he also feels that he is a member of a people, one people. He must have some policy with regard to the outer world. He cannot help but consider present conditions. He cannot consider them without being stirred to speculate upon what the outcome must be. And he cannot speculate on the outcome without in some manner endeavoring to make it as he would like it to be. The invisible government of the Jews, its attitude toward the Gentile world, its policy with regard to the future, are not, then, the abnormal things that some would make them appear. Given the Jewish position, they are of all things most natural. Jewish existence in this world is not such as woos the Jew into sleepy contentment. It is such as stirs him into organization against future contingencies and into programs which may shape those contingencies to the benefit of his race. That there should be a Sanhedrin of the Jews, a world body of the leading men of all countries, the leading Jewish men of all countries, that there should even be an exilarch, a visible and recognized head of the Sanhedrin, mystically foreshadowing the autocrat to come, that there should even be a world program, just as every government has its foreign policy, are not strange, uncanny suppositions. They grow normally out of the situation itself. And it is also natural that not every Jew should know this. The Sanhedrin always was the aristocracy, and would be so today. When rabbis cry from their pulpits that they know nothing about this thing, they are doubtless telling the truth. What the international Jew depends upon is the likelihood of every Jew approving that which brings power and prestige to his people. At any rate, it is well enough known that however little the ordinary Jewish leader may have been told about world programs, he regards with the greatest respect and confidence the very men who must put these programs through, if these exist at all. The 24th protocol of the learned elders of Zion has this to say:
Now I will discuss the manner in which the roots of the house of King David will penetrate to the deepest strata of the earth. This dynasty, even to this day, has given the power of controlling world affairs to our wise men, the educational directors of all human thought.
This would indicate, if reliable, that, as the protocol goes on to recite, the autocrat himself has not appeared. But the dynasty, or the Davidic line, in which he must appear, have entrusted the work of preparing for him to the wise men of Zion. These wise men are represented not only as preparing those who exercise rulership over Judaism's affairs, but also as framing and influencing the world's thought toward ends which shall be propitious to these plans. Whatever may be hidden in the program, it is certain that its execution or the effects of its execution cannot be hidden. Therefore, it may be possible to find in the outer world the clues which, traced back to their source, reveal the existence of a program whose promise for the world, good or bad, ought to be widely known.
Okay.
You there, Carolyn?
Yeah, I'm here. A couple of things here. You know, now what they're doing here is they find not at all difficult, the writers here, and obviously Ford too. They find it not difficult to believe that the protocols can be, you know, a secret Jewish manuscript. And they have been setting up the stage here, and I don't think, you know, I don't think they're doing it, you know, by trying to fool people, but showing how all of this kind of thinking goes all the way back in Jewish thought and why this is just why this could be a continuation of something that's really very old in Jewish thought amongst the elites, but which, as I said before, the common Jew will easily go along with. And I think something that's real important, when they said, of all things, Jewish existence in this world is not such as woos the Jew into sleepy contentment. It is such as stirs him into organization against future contingencies and into programs which may shape these contingencies for the benefit of his race. Well, this is something that they have going for them, and we have not. We have not seen that we had any problems with benefiting our race, and probably the Christian religion did do a lot over the years to put people into sleepy contentment. This is I think an important idea that we need to really wake up and only some of us now realize that, but most European peoples, they still have no idea that they might have an idea, but they don't feel any, they don't have the, they're not stirred into organization to do anything about it. So, and then the other thing I had, large here was, that these, wise men of Zion, that the whole thing they're doing there is framing and influencing the world's thought towards ends which shall be propitious to these plans. Well, we know that they are doing that, whether the protocols are a forgery or not, and I'm going to have some things to say about that, because, of course, I did look at the evidence today, and it is kind of strong that they're not, about the copying and so. I mean, 17 whole chapters or something like that. So, still, we see the effect, and we see that what they're saying there, they're actually doing. I mean, it's actually happening. So it's interesting, and this idea that we are being influenced towards their ends, toward ends that they have decided upon, and we are really caught in this web of their influence now. So that's... Mm-hmm. And it's that. Now, before we start the new one, I just have this little thing from that says that Henry Ford funded the printing of 500,000 copies of the protocols. Where is this? That were distributed throughout the United States in the 1920s. Well, good for him. He not only did his Dearborn Independent and so on, but he funded 500,000 copies. Yeah.
Do you know what year he had those printed? Was it before 1921?
It says he did this in the 1920s.
You see, the exposition of the plagiarism in the protocols was in 1921.
Okay, so this is before this was brought forth. Okay.
I'm imagining that he had those things printed up in 1920 and 21, and may have stopped it after the evidence of plagiarism came out.
Yeah, it says that he, you don't know how accurate this is, but it said he funded the printing and, that were distributed in the 1920s. Well, you can't make out exactly from the way that's written when they were distributed, but probably in 1920. He was serious about it. Oh.
Yeah. I can understand why somebody would think it was true if they didn't have evidence to the contrary. But, even Nihlus said that he had no idea he couldn't prove that it was authentic, except that the content seemed accurate.
Well,
but that
that's
doesn't prove
it.
Anything.
Well, they are, though, so accurate. That's the thing. It's kind of
except that
uncanny.
The Jews don't quite operate that way.
No matter what method how they exactly operate or talk, They are operating that. I mean, they are bringing all those things about, and they have a lot, in large part, come about.
All this stuff about an exilarch and a Sanhedrin is superfluous.
Well, they thought they would probably did some research and found all that stuff and thought they'd put it in there because it shows what they've been doing. They've had these secret groups throughout their whole history, so it's not unusual kind of behavior for them. That's the way I see it. Well, let's go ahead with our, this is the first of like 10 chapters, no, 7, 8 chapters, 8 chapters that have to do with the Protocols, that famous book.
All right.
Protocols of the Learned Elders. So here we go. All right.
Chapter 10, An Introduction to the Jewish Protocols. The documents most frequently mentioned by those who are interested in the theory of Jewish world power rather than in the actual operation of that power in the world today are those 24 documents known as the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion. The Protocols have attracted much attention in Europe, having become the center of an important storm of opinion in England only recently, but discussion of them in the United States has been limited. These are the documents concerning which the Department of Justice was making inquiries more than a year ago, and which were given publication in London by Eyre and Spottiswoode, the official printers to the British government. Who it was that first entitled these documents with the name of the Elders of Zion is not known. It would be possible, without serious mutilation of the documents, to remove all hint of Jewish authorship, and yet retain all the main points of the most comprehensive program for world subjugation that has ever come to public knowledge. Yet it must be said that thus to eliminate all hint of Jewish authorship would be to bring out a number of contradictions which do not exist in the Protocols in their present form. The purpose of the plan revealed in the Protocols is to undermine all authority in order that a new authority in the form of autocracy may be set up. Such a plan could not emanate from a ruling class which already possessed authority, although it might emanate from anarchists. But anarchists do not avow autocracy as the ultimate condition they seek. The authors might be conceived as a company of French subversives such as existed at the time of the French Revolution and had the infamous Duke of Orleans, Duke d'Orléans, as their leader. But this would involve a contradiction between the fact that those subversives have passed away and the fact that the program announced in these protocols is being steadily carried out, not only in France, but throughout Europe and very noticeably in the United States. In their present form, which bears evidence of being their original form, there is no contradiction. The allegation of Jewish authorship seems essential to the consistency of the plan.
Okay, so that so what I get from this is that who would have reason for doing this? You know, who would want to have a plan like this? It wouldn't be ruling classes. It wouldn't even be the anarchists. It wouldn't even be the revolutionaries. I mean, it doesn't fit anybody, but it does fit what we know about the Jews. What do you think of that little argument there?
Well, let's see. He's saying that the content as well as the title indicate Jewish authorship, but this is not surprising since it tells us in an oversimplified form what we already knew about the Jews. And I would also say that Jews don't want autocracy. They want disorder.
They want disorder, yeah, until they put in place the autocracy. Of course, they're not saying that they want that right now. They create disorder in order to put themselves in power. That's it. That's a given. And that's what they're talking about.
Well,
come on.
I'm not so sure about that. Well, because when the Jews themselves take control, it doesn't go that well.
Well, let's go on.
They do better as parasites. Let's see.
Well, maybe they don't know that yet. Maybe they think they can do that. Maybe
okay.
They've got a plan.
Okay, we left off at if these documents.
Yeah, right.
Okay. If these documents were the forgeries which Jewish apologists claim them to be, the forgers would probably have taken pains to make Jewish authorship so clear that their anti-Semitic purpose could easily have been detected. But only twice is the term Jew used in them. After one has read much further than the average reader usually cares to go into such matters, one comes upon the plans for the establishment of the world autocrat, and only then is it made clear of what lineage he is to be. But all through the documents, there is left no doubt as to the people against whom the plan is aimed. It is not aimed against aristocracy as such. It is not aimed against capital as such. It is not aimed against government as such. Very definite provisions are made for the enlistment of aristocracy, capital, and government for the execution of the plan. It is aimed against the people of the world who are called Gentiles. It is the frequent mention of Gentiles that really decides the purpose of the documents. Most of the destructive type of liberal plans aim at the enlistment of the people as helpers. This plan aims at the degeneration of the people in order that they may be reduced to confusion of mind and thus manipulated. Popular movements of a liberal kind are to be encouraged. All the disruptive philosophies in religion, economics, politics, and domestic life are to be sown and watered for the purpose of so disintegrating social solidarity that a definite plan herein set forth may be put through without notice, and the people then molded to it when the fallacy of these philosophies is shown.
So, you know, this is, reminds me of Tanstoffel saying so often that the target of the he doesn't always use the word Jews, but, that's basically what he means, is white people. And they've got everybody else targeting white people, you know, all the non-white races. Here they use the word Gentiles, but they mean white people, really. I guess that would maybe be the best substitute today for Gentiles.
Well, this is a very interesting passage right here where it talks about... Mm-hmm. You look at the patriotard milieu, and there are actually quite a few Jews that have gotten into that and misdirected things in various ways, in my opinion. Seems to pertain to that. Maybe some Jews got ideas from the protocols, even though they're not authentic.
Oh, sure. I mean, that seems to be their idea, whether... and then they say, yeah, popular movements of a liberal kind are to be encouraged to disrupt religion, you know, religious thought, economics, politics, and domestic life. We haven't even got to the moral part, the morality that they're attacking, and they're really doing that today. So,
okay. The formula of speech is not... We Jews will do this, but the Gentiles will be made to think and do these things. With the exception of a few instances in the closing protocols, the only distinctive racial term used is Gentiles. To illustrate, the first indication of this kind comes in the first protocol in this way. The great qualities of the people, honesty and frankness, are essentially vices in politics, because they dethrone more surely and more certainly than does the strongest enemy. These qualities are attributes of Gentile rule. We certainly must not be guided by them. And again, on the ruins of the hereditary aristocracy of the Gentiles, we have set up the aristocracy of our educated class, and over all the aristocracy of money. We have established the basis of this new aristocracy on the basis of riches, which we control, and on the science guided by our wise men. Again.
Okay, and that's... Go ahead.
We will force wages.
Oh, again. Well, here
which,
I want to comment on this. On the ruins of the hereditary aristocracy of the Gentiles. You know, that's exactly what they've done. They have slowly, over the course of the last century, destroyed... The natural aristocracy of the Gentiles and caused a lot of people, and maybe for some good reasons, but...
Well, hereditary aristocracy, you're talking about, like, the kings and European nobles. We never had that here, really.
No, but they did it there. They did it in Europe, and they have set themselves up. As we see now, everything we hear about is Jews who are so highly educated, they're so smart, they have all these, they're out filling up the law courts, and they're filling up judgeships, and filling up every kind of profession and so on. and the aristocracy of money. I mean, that's exactly what's happened. The aristocracy of people with supposed, you know, long family histories, which give them a high quality education and an interest in their own people and so on. That, you know, was that a lot of aristocrats did have back at one time, when the world was a lot different than it is now. They have destroyed all that. And it was the Jews who did it. So, okay, again.
Again. We will force up wages, which, however, will be of no benefit to workers, for we at the same time will cause a rise in the prices of prime necessities, pretending that this is due to the decline of agriculture and of cattle raising. We will also artfully and deeply undermine the sources of production by instilling in the workmen ideas of anarchy and encourage them in the use of alcohol. At the same time, taking measures to drive all the intellectual forces of the Gentiles from the land.
You know, when you read it with that accent, which tends to sound kind of like a New York, even though you're trying not to, it sort of brings about the feeling that these are just idiot people who are dreaming up something that they can't possibly do, rather than being very serious, high-class Jews, like the ones you mentioned earlier, Justice Brandeis and the
Lord
other
Redding.
Fellow, Lord Redding, that don't talk like that and are the real dangerous ones, you know, who really are serious about this. It still is fun to listen to you, but the idea of, there's instilling in the workmen the ideas of anarchy and alcohol, and they, you know, of course, in Germany, Hitler is National Socialist. They had that to deal with, the labor union unrest and so on. It was all taken over by communists. So, but it wasn't just Jews who were the communists there, but they were probably behind it all.
Yeah. Okay. A forger with anti-Semitic malice might have written this any time within the past 5 years. But these words were in print at least 14 years ago, according to British evidence, a copy having been in the British Museum since 1906, and they were circulated in Russia a number of years prior. Well, there was just something going on in Russia in 1906. They had war with Japan, and there was like some disturbance going on in Russia at the time, some socialist disturbance, which Jews were probably involved in.
But they're just talking about this book, right? These words
the protocols
that they,
appeared
that
around
they
that
first
time.
Appeared, yeah. And of course, they weren't Russian. It didn't originate in Russia, but it ended up.
I mean,
in a Russian translation.
This is written as if the person wasn't aware that there was also some stuff going on in 1906.
Oh well, maybe they didn't think that was so important. Because they're not talking about the unrest so much; they're talking about the book. Stars, I can read it.
The above point continues. That is the true situation. That the true situation shall not be noticed by the Gentiles prematurely. We will mask it by a pretended effort to serve the working classes and promote great economic principles, for which an active propaganda will be carried on through our economic theories.
Okay, well, you know, that's serious stuff there. They're gonna pretend to serve the working classes while they're actually, carrying out their economic theories, which is to destroy the economy.
Yeah, Marxism sort of works that way because, you know, as we've discussed, other times, it focuses on the industrialist and doesn't say anything about the finance capitalist, who are largely Jews.
Yeah. That's a real good point.
These quotations will illustrate the style of the protocols in making reference to the parties involved. It is we for the writers and Gentiles for those who are being written about. This is brought out very clearly in the 14th protocol. In this divergence between the Gentiles and ourselves, inability to think and reason, is to be seen clearly the seal of our election as the chosen people, as higher human beings, in contrast with the Gentiles, who have merely instinctive and animal minds. They observe, but they do not foresee, and they invent nothing except perhaps material things. It is clear from this that nature herself predestined us to rule and guide the world.
That's kind of crazy, because to say that the Gentiles don't invent anything, and these people do, what did they ever invent? They steal everything.
Well,
so
yeah,
they're really off the ball there. This is just making something.
Yeah,
up.
If they'd actually said that, it would be pretty ridiculous.
Yeah.
Okay. This, of course, has been the Jewish method of dividing humanity from the earliest times. The world was only Jew and Gentile. All that was not Jew was Gentile.
Yeah, to the Jews, as you said last week. To the Jews, from way back, there was Jews, and then everything else was Gentile. But you know,
yeah,
that's common.
Also, Christians get sucked into that also.
Well, yeah, because that's common with all peoples. I remember, you know, there are Indian, American Indian tribes who, their word for themselves was something like man or human or something like that.
Yeah.
And then everybody else was something else. You know, they were the only ones. So this is typical of tribal peoples.
Yeah, the human beings.
Yeah.
The use of the word Jew in the protocol may be illustrated by this passage in the 8th section. For the time being, until it will be safe to give responsible government positions to our brother Jews, we shall entrust them to people whose past and whose characters are such that there is an abyss between them and the people.
Well, I guess they're just pointing out here that they use the word Jew. They only use the word Jew a couple of times. And they're pointing out where they did use the word Jew. They usually just say we and us and our. But a couple of times they did use the word Jew. That's what they're pointing out here, I think, as I recall from previously reading it. And that's all, just a couple examples. I think these are the only two places they said that they found the word Jew. But they never found any other word, you know, any other people's name. It was always just us, we will do this.
You know, actually, though, that previous passage that we talked about that said that the Gentiles never invent anything, you can find some statements that are just as outrageous from certain segments of the Jewish population, especially the Lubavitchers, who will say things like the Jewish body is completely different from the Gentile body.
Oh, they're crazy. The Lubavitchers
like are just, yeah, those are the craziest of the Jews.
Nuts.
Even other Jews think they're crazy.
Yeah, but they're not. They can't. You know, most Jews must not like them because they don't do anything good for the image of Jews amongst.
They seem to be very influential in the state of Israel.
I know.
Because. This Jew astronaut was a Lubavitcher. I think he's one that got blown up.
Elie Wiesel is a good friend of the Lubavitchers because he's in the same Hasidic sect. You know, the Hasidic sect is full of all the nuts and crazy people, and he's one of them. You know, so and his family and all that, they came from that, and he's done all kinds of things for the Lubavitchers. Of course, they've had him come to speak at their annual meetings and so on, and they pay him a huge amount of money because they've got so damn much money. So naturally, he likes everybody who gives him a bunch of money. Ugh.
Yeah.
But he's done a lot for them, and they like him.
Yeah. Anyway, the idea of this last passage here is to have Gentile frontmen that won't have any support from the people, so that they cannot become independent from the Jews. They'll be stuck as puppets.
Yeah.
This is the practice known as using Gentile fronts, which is extensively practiced in the financial world today in order to cover up the evidences of Jewish control. How much progress has been made since these words were written is indicated by the occurrence at the San Francisco Convention when the name of Judge Brandeis was proposed for president. It is reasonably to be expected that the public mind will be made more and more familiar with the idea of Jewish occupancy, which will be really a short step from the present degree of influence which the Jews exercise of the highest office in the government. There is no function of the American presidency in which the Jews have not already secretly assisted in a very important degree. Actual occupancy of the office is not necessary to enhance their power, but to promote certain things which parallel very closely the plans outlined in the protocols now before us.
Now, what's that all about? I was not able to... I was trying to find my place again. And what are they saying?
Well, he's kind of talking circuitously there, hinting at something without really saying. Actual occupancy of the office of president is not necessary to enhance their power, but to promote certain things which parallel very closely the plans outlined in the protocols now before us.
Well, they've never tried to have a president yet, although they almost had a vice president.
Well, probably the Roosevelts probably are Jews.
Oh, I think so. But yeah, you're right. Maybe they have some crypto Jews. Maybe they've just stuck with the crypto Jews for president. Who knows? And then they have, of course, the Jewish advisors. I think they like having the Jewish advisors. They're not quite ready to just put Jews in top office. They'd rather put blacks there.
Well, see, the thing is, if they have a Jew as the head of state instead of a Gentile front man as head of state, when things go wrong, they can be held responsible.
Yeah, true. That's right. Yeah, the way they do it, it works out best for them because they have all the influence.
By the way, have you ever looked at Obama's mother in profile? There's a picture of her holding this black baby in profile.
Yeah, I think
her
I've
nose
seen
is
that
very
picture.
Interesting.
Well, I never thought it looked like a Jewish nose. Do you think so? I don't
know.
It's
kind of a humpy-looking nose.
Is it?
Yeah.
Well?
Father's a banker.
Her father's a banker?
Yeah.
I thought her father was a farmer. You know, that's right. They just went and lived on that farm after a while. They weren't really farmers most of their life. They went and lived in Iowa somewhere. I don't even know if they live on a farm. That's probably some big story that was put out back when I first heard about him. I thought his parents and his mother and his grandparents were farmers.
Obama's mother's mother also has a very large nose.
Well, I believe it. That's why they go along with all that stuff.
Another point which the reader of the protocols will notice is that the tone of exhortation is entirely absent from these documents. They are not propaganda. They are not efforts to stimulate the ambitions or activity of those to whom they are addressed. They are as cool as a legal paper and as matter of fact as a table of statistics. There is none of the, "Let us rise, my brothers," stuff about them. There is no "down with the Gentiles" hysteria. These protocols, if indeed they were made by Jews and confided to Jews, or if they do contain certain principles of a Jewish world program, were certainly not intended for the firebrands, but for the carefully prepared and tested initiates of the higher groups.
Well, that's good analysis, I think.
Well,
you know,
all he's really showing there is it's not a really heavy-handed forgery. That's all it's really showing.
It's not about the forgery. It's about the style. It's not a heavy-handed style. It's all a clear, cold, calculated talk. There's no exhortation, you know, we'll do this and we're going to do that. You know, it's not anything emotional at all.
Okay. Jewish apologists have asked, is it conceivable that if there were such a world program on the part of the Jews, they would reduce it to writing and publish it? But there's no evidence that these protocols were ever uttered otherwise than in spoken words by those who put them forth. The protocols as we have them are apparently the notes of lectures which were made by someone who heard them. Some of them are lengthy, some of them are brief.
There you go.
Which
now, why are some lengthy and some brief? It seems like, I'll have to go through that book and study that and see if I have time.
The assertion, which has always been made in connection with the protocols since they have become known, is that they are the notes of lectures delivered to Jewish students, probably somewhere in France or Switzerland. The attempt to make them appear to be of Russian origin is absolutely forestalled by the point of view, the references to the times, and certain grammatical indications.
Well, we have to take their word for that, because I don't know.
Well, if you translate an expression from, say, French, into some other language, it was, if you translate it literally, you can still recognize it was translated from French, because the way they would say it in French would be different.
Good.
The tone certainly fits the supposition that they were originally lectures given to students, for their purpose is clearly not to get a program accepted, but to give information concerning a program, which is represented as being already in process of fulfillment. There is no invitation to join forces or to offer opinions. Indeed, it is specifically announced that neither discussion nor opinions are desired. While preaching liberalism to the Gentiles, we shall hold our own people and our own agents in unquestioning obedience. The scheme of administration must emanate from a single brain. Therefore, we may know the plan of action, but we must not discuss it, lest we destroy its unique character. The inspired work of our leader must therefore not be thrown before a crowd to be torn to pieces, or even before a limited group. Moreover, taking the protocols at their face value, it is evident that the program outlined in these lecture notes was not a new one at the time the lectures were given. There is no evidence of its being a recent arrangement. There's almost the tone of a tradition or a religion in it all, as if it had been handed down from generation to generation through the medium of specially trusted and initiated men. There is no note of new discovery or fresh enthusiasm in it, but the certitude and calmness of facts long known and policies long confirmed by experiment.
Well, what do you think of that argument?
Oh, it's a lot of speculation, really, because, all you know, if something
is... No, it's
is,
not. Is it does have that. It does have that about it. I mean, yeah. Okay, well, I guess I should interrupt because we got a bit to finish.
This is yet. Really a lot of...
I know you don't like
it. Much ado about nothing, really. This point of the age of the program is touched upon at least twice in the protocols themselves. In the first protocol, this paragraph occurs. Already in ancient times, we were the first to to shout the words liberty, equality, fraternity among the people. These words have been repeated many times since by unconscious poll parrots, flocking from all sides to this bait, with which they have ruined the prosperity of the world and true personal freedom. The presumably clever and intelligent Gentiles did not understand the symbolism of the uttered words, did not observe their contradiction in meaning, did not notice that in nature there is no equality.
Well, now they say that in ancient times, we were the first to shout liberty, equality, fraternity. So that did not come from the French Revolution, that already existed, those words in that sense before the French Revolution, and the French Revolution kind of picked it up?
I'm not sure if that exact slogan existed, but some similar movements existed in the ancient world. There was a conspiracy of the cult of Dionysus that Livy wrote about.
Okay, well, that's probably what they're referring to then. All righty.
Well, I mean, the Jews were doing insurrections in ancient times, too.
That's right. I would say they didn't use those exact words, but they had that same idea.
I don't know.
Yeah.
The other reference to the program's finality is found in the 13th protocol. Questions of policy, however, are permitted to no one except those who have originated the policy and have directed it for many centuries. Can this be a reference to a secret Jewish Sanhedrin, self-perpetuating within a certain Jewish caste from generation to generation? Again, it must be said that the originators and directors here referred to cannot be, at present, any ruling caste, for all that the program contemplates is directly opposed to the interests of such a caste. It cannot refer to any national aristocratic group like the Junkers of Germany, for the methods which are proposed are the very ones which would render powerless such a group. It cannot refer to any but a people who have no government, who have everything to gain and nothing to lose, and who can keep themselves intact amid a crumbling world. There's only one group that answers that description. Again, a reading of the protocols makes it clear that the speaker himself was not seeking for honor. There is a complete absence of personal ambition throughout the document. all plans and purposes and expectations are merged in the future of Israel. Which future, it would seem, can only be secured by the subtle breaking down of certain world ideas held by the Gentiles.
World ideas. I like that.
Yeah, world ideas. Breaking down of certain world ideas. The protocols speak of what has been done, what was being done at the time these words were given, and what remained to be done. Nothing like them in completeness of detail, in breadth of plan, and in deep grasp of the hidden springs of human action has ever been known. They are verily terrible in their mastery of the secrets of life, equally terrible in their consciousness of that mastery. Truly, they would merit the opinion which Jews have recently cast upon them, that they were the work of an inspired madman, were it not that what is written in the protocols in words is also written upon the life of today in deeds and tendencies. The criticisms which these protocols pass upon the Gentiles for their stupidity are just. It is impossible to disagree with a single item in the protocol's description of Gentile mentality and venality. Even the most astute of the Gentile thinkers have been fooled into receiving as the motions of progress, what has only been insinuated into the common human mind by the most insidious systems of propaganda.
Okay, now here, you know, they are saying, they're going along with that idea that these Gentiles are not all so, they don't even disagree with the protocols, they're saying. It is impossible to disagree with the protocol's description of Gentile mentality and venality, which
how
is
the
really
masses of people are fooled.
Yeah, right. They're easily fooled, and they respond to low rewards, you know, low-level rewards of whatever, you know. Not high level.
That's not a new observation. Plato talks about that.
Well, I know, but we're trying to look at the white race as having noble qualities and being better than others. But here again, we've got the people tearing down the white race. They call them Gentiles, but talk about how stupid we are and how easily fooled. But you know, there's plenty of evidence for it.
Well, but, you know, Plato said the multitude of the people is incapable of philosophy. That's Plato. Mm-hmm. And some other Athenians from around the same time made similar observations.
Yeah, even back then. And we're supposed to think that the early Greeks back then were also intelligent. But they talk about their mass of people the same way mm-hmm. we talk about them now.
Yeah, the Athenians were supposed to be an entire standard deviation smarter than the English, according to Galton. I'm not sure.
Who is supposed to be?
Francis Galton.
No, who is supposed to be a whole standard?
The classical Athenians.
Oh, yeah, that's what I have heard some scholars say that. Yeah. I guess they're basing it on something. Well, then we're just even in worse shape today.
And even for them, democracy didn't work that well. Okay. Yeah. It is true that here and there a thinker has arisen to say that science, so-called, was not science at all. It is true that here and there a thinker has arisen to say that the so-called economic laws of both conservatives and radicals were not laws at all, but artificial inventions. It is true that occasionally a keen observer has asserted that the recent debauch of luxury and extravagance was not due to the natural impulses of the people at all, but was systematically stimulated, foisted upon them by design. It is true that a few have discerned that more than half of what passes for public opinion is mere hired applause and booing and has never impressed the public mind. But even with these clues here and there, for the most part disregarded, there has never been enough continuity and collaboration between those who were awake to follow all the clues to their source. The chief explanation for the hold which the protocols have had on many of the leading statesmen of the world for several decades is that they explain whence all these false influences come and what their purpose is. They give a clue to the modern maze. It is now time for the people to know, and whether the protocols are judged as proving anything concerning the Jews or not, they constitute an education in the way the masses are turned about like sheep by influences which they do not understand. It is almost certain that once the principles of the protocols are known widely and understood by the people, the criticism which they now rightly make of the Gentile mind will no longer hold good. It is the purpose of future articles in this series to study these documents and to answer out of their contents all the questions that may arise concerning them. Before that work is begun, one question should be answered. Is there likelihood of the program of the protocols being carried through to success? The program is successful already. In many of its most important phases, it is already a reality. But this need not cause alarm, for the chief weapon to be used against such a program, both in its completed and uncompleted parts, is clear publicity. Let the people know. Arousing the people, alarming the people, appealing to the passions of the people is the method of the plan outlined in the protocols. The antidote is merely enlightening the people. That is the only purpose of these articles. Enlightenment dispels prejudice. It is as desirable to dispel the prejudice of the Jew as of the Gentile. Jewish writers, too, frequently assume that the prejudice is all on one side. The protocols themselves ought to have the widest circulation among the Jewish people in order that they may check those things which are bringing suspicion upon their name.
Well, that's the end of this chapter, 24th July, 1920, Dearborn Independent. And I just say, ha, 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 so funny to think that you're going to dispel the prejudice of the Jew and the Gentile both. And just saying that the Jewish writers too frequently assume that prejudice is all on one side. And they think that if they can circulate the protocols, that is going to be the method of change. Well, you know, it would be. And this is one thing that I think is very influential on my mind, that if these protocols were really circulated around and people got the idea more and more that this could be true, that this was really came from the Jews, that would destroy what they're doing, because it would shine the light on it. So the first thing they had to do was to say, this is a hoax, this is a hoax, this is a hoax, and insist that it was a hoax. Now, I'm not saying that it's not doesn't have a lot of plagiarism. I was trying to think about if the parts that are in here are from things that were written later. Were they written later or earlier?
Earlier.
Oh, they were written earlier. Yeah. Okay. I thought I had. Okay. They were written earlier. So, It's a very strong argument that they're not it is very strong, but at the same time, whoever did it did a damn good job, and maybe the Jews are just copying it, but it seems like that's always been their plan. So, well, we've got a lot of chapters to delve into this, and I think they're going to be very interesting.
Well, it kind of shows the technique of subversion that could be used by a number of different groups, perhaps.
Well, that's right. That's right, and we need to know that. I mean, it is enlightening for us. It's hugely informative, and it teaches us how this stuff is being done to us. And we need to know that, no matter where it originated from. So I think it's valuable. Well, we are at the end of our show again. Thanks very much, Hadding, and thank you listeners. We will be back next week for our next chapter. 11. So see you. Come back with us then.
Hooray, Jake, hooray, John, breaking up drinks all night long.
Thanks for listening. The International Jew Study Hour will return next week, exclusively on the White Network.